You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
It is the Anfield Wrap. It is the first of our big questions. We're going to be doing them every single Monday during the World Cup. Well, more accurately, until it looks as though reasonable, normal football is back on the horizon, insofar as any football is reasonable or normal, which we'll be coming on to in a minute or two. The first one we were going to do, we sort of worked this out a fair few weeks back, that we were going to do this, and we said, let's do the first one about Fenway Sports Group and their ownership of Liverpool. And basically, they've ruined that, haven't they? Events have somewhat overtaken it, that conversation. So it's going to be about the past, present and future of FSG. We will still touch on that a little bit in brief, but obviously now we're talking about ownership structures and what people actually want. But before all of that, coming up also in December, if you subscribe to the Anfield Wrap, is our Klopp documentary, five parts on Jurgen Klopp, the first three out in December. And here is a little clip of the wonderful, wonderful audio that's been done. Although I will point out the whole thing is a video. Here it is.
He was catching all the people. The people was hanging on his lips. This was absolutely fantastic. I will never forget this. This is the highlight of my life.
Undoubtedly, Jurgen's biggest strength and the biggest sort of key to his success has been his, you know, rejuvenation of the fan base, you know what I mean? We feel alive again. We feel wanted again. We feel part of something again.
He hurt with us, you know, you could see that. You know, some managers kind of hide their emotions sometimes and things like that. He definitely doesn't. And, you know, when we went through the tough moments and in terms of being maybe upset or being, you know, gutted in terms of losing finals or, like you said, having a pretty much perfect season and still not coming away with the trophy and things like that, then, you know, he showed that kind of, you know, vulnerable side, and it probably allowed us to do it.
And I'm very proud because, you know, he made our club famous worldwide.
Marvellous stuff. Back in the room with Ian Ryan, with Dan Austin and with Phil Blundell. A pleasure to have the three of them here for this one. This was, is still the big question. If anything, the big question's got bigger, Phil, because we've got to confront the reality of this now. I think we've got to accept that we are now in a realm which we weren't in sort of 6 weeks ago, or more accurately, we now know we're in a realm that we may well have been in 6 weeks ago, but now it's clear that there is a genuine openness from Fenway Sports Group to sell their interest, the whole of their interest in Liverpool Football Club. It may only ever be a partial thing, but it's interesting to me that this conversation prior to that knowledge might well have been a fair few people saying it might be time for them to move on and so forth. We've now got to grasp the reality of that while sort of assessing the past and present moment that's brought us here.
Yeah, we do. I mean, we don't know. As I say, we don't really know how long this has been going on at all. They didn't knock up a sales brochure that David Ornstein happened to stumble upon in a morning. This is something. I mean, I get the impression that he's found this as opposed to FSG have found him, and he's sort of blown the roof off the whole thing, because I think they quite happily would have kept it under wraps, and they've been sort of, it's been exposed. I think the fact that he had a statement from them as he broke the story would tell you that it's possibly been going on longer than any of us really would think. I mean, it wouldn't shock me if this is a 6 month to a year general process, because when you break it down, you can look at the situation we found ourselves in. Like, I don't really see how the club gets more valuable now in terms of the football can't consistently become better that makes the value of the club better.
Do you mean that right, football? Do you mean right now?
Not literally now, but more that, you know, we played in three of the last five Champions League finals, for example. Yeah. It's not something that is that can be massively improved on to make us better at football, right? In the short term, we could not be, what, sixth or seventh or whatever we are, and we could look like we're in a title challenge and so on and so forth, but there's that. I don't really see how the ground gets bigger. There's no other general infrastructure that gets bigger. The sponsorship deals feel like they could obviously also rake in a few quid revenue and new, but they're not massively punching under. So it's sort of they've got to a situation where they're like, right, well, this is our time. We're sort of wasting our time trying to grow it by more when all we can make more now is a little bit. I always thought they'd sell FSG as a whole to, because obviously it's a lot of people selling bits and pieces. And I thought that the long game would be that they'd just sell FSG off and keep this and buy more assets like an American football team or a basketball team. You know, they bought an NHL team, and that's what I thought they'd do. But now I've sort of thought about it, it makes a lot of sense that they've sat down and gone, okay, this is about as valuable as we can make it. So probably time to get out, and it makes a bit of sense. And we probably, if we'd have sat down and thought about it, we possibly could and should have seen it coming, maybe, I suppose.
About as valuable as they can make it, Ian, I'm sort of intrigued with this, because if that's the case, then at least by their own outlook, they'll feel as though, well, we've done a good job. And that, you know, when we have these conversations, I think that's the difficulty in a couple of ways is simply where and how you end up concluding what constitutes a good job or a bad job. And, you know, as part of whatever happens next, I think you've almost got to have a bit of an answer to that, to be honest with you, because whoever it is who's coming in next, if it can't become more valuable, if that's Phil's argument, and I don't entirely agree with him in the long run of football, we'll circle back around, I'm sure, but allow him for that for a second or two, then it sort of begs the question of, if you can't make it more valuable, then who's buying it and why?
Yeah, potentially so. I think in terms of it getting more valuable, maybe around the TV rights, at some point that becomes a thing in a conversation again, where actually there's more money to be made. But I take Phil's point, sitting here right now, it's kind of difficult to maybe ascertain whether that's something that's going to come kind of short to medium term. I think, listen, in my opinion, Neil, they've done fine at times. You know, you'll always have to give them lots of credit for getting the manager over the line, because that's ultimately what I think has brought us to the dance in terms of the major trophies. You know, if you look at the kind of, you know, the tenure up until 2015, I think you see one League Cup, Jürgen comes through the door, and I think they all kind of sign off on a way of working, really. And I think everyone was left in no uncertain terms about what they were bringing to the table. So I think when they interviewed the manager in 2015 in New York, they all leave that room knowing that they're responsible for this part of the operation. And Jürgen, you know, he gets asked in that interview, you know, tell us what your football philosophy is. And I'm paraphrasing slightly, but he tells them to fuck off because they won't understand it. I think they know that he's the man in terms of who's going to look after all the football stuff, and they're going to look after all the commercial deals. And I think, you know, broadly speaking, that's all gone pretty well. I think where I'm left is a bit, could they have done a little bit more at times? Are the times when actually they could have maybe just put the foot down a little bit? And that may have resulted in one or two extra trophies, but it might not, because you never know with transfers and stuff. You know, some of the times they'll come in and they'll work, and actually what they have got in recent years is a really good track record of making the transfers work. But sometimes players come in and it doesn't quite happen, and it doesn't go the way you want it to. So I'm always left a little bit, well, they could have done a little bit more. So it's never been for me about, actually, let's get them out the club. Because I think when you have a conversation about the ownership, there's loads of nuance to it, and I think that's important. And often you'll hear arguments for and against, and it's so extreme, it's bordering on ridiculous, when actually there's lots of nuance in there. And I think, you know, some of that is about, at certain moments of their ownership, could they have just given the manager a little bit of help at certain times? You know, I always come back to the campaign where they're decimated by injuries, and the defenders are out, and they could have probably pulled the trigger, and they should have, in my opinion, but they don't. And I think when Jürgen joins the club, I think he knows exactly what he's getting. I don't think there's any real surprises. I think he understands how the operation and how the model's going to work, and I think he's fine with that as well, because I think he wouldn't want full control of anything. So when he comes out at times in the last 2 or 3 years and says stuff, I think it's because he's really frustrated and he maybe wanted a little bit more from them, and he hasn't quite got the little bit more that maybe would have helped and maybe would have resulted in one or two extra trophies. We don't know. But listen, I think he gets on with them really well, and I think he'll be sad maybe if they do go, because I think it's difficult to get those working relationships where everyone pretty much is in tandem. And whatever business you're operating in, you're never all going to be agreeing on everything. That's impossible.
The working relationships part for me, Dan, is the most interesting part, and the bit of this which I think opens up, throws up, if you're paying attention, the most anxiety, in that it does feel at the minute like the football club has a solid series, and has had a solid series of working relationships in a general sense, and anything that is new will therefore threaten that. Now, they could become better, don't get me wrong, you know, it does go both ways, but there is a level of functionality right the way through the football club that maybe, you know, we hadn't seen pre-1990, and it was just such a different era then. It was such a different time. It's hard to say and hard to tell. But the working relationships part is the bit where, you know, if you want to ask me in general about, you know, without me doing jokes about it, about what's the best bit of the Fenway sort of sports group ownership, for me it ends up being that it feels as though most bits of the football club have worked really well together in tandem.
In that sort of list of relationships that you're talking about, the one that's most important is with the supporters, I think. And I will preface that by saying that I obviously am a Liverpool supporter, and I have actively protested against this ownership of Liverpool Football Club by walking out of a football stadium because I didn't like what they were doing. But if you compare the state of the club's relationship with fans in 2010 to what it is now, it's a world of difference in a positive sense. I mean, in 2010, people like Andy and Gareth were on a document created by people at Liverpool Football Club, effectively listing them as enemies of the institution, which is insane to think about now, but it's true, it happened. And all that those people were doing was trying to safeguard the future of Liverpool Football Club. Now we're at a point where, after a whole array of missteps, the vast majority of which shouldn't have happened, and they should have foreseen, they shouldn't have needed to be told, but after missteps on things like the ticket prices, the trademarking of the name, the Super League, I'm sure there are other things that I'm forgetting.
The furlough, whatever else.
We're now at a point where there is a very strong working relationship between the people that own Liverpool and the supporters. You know, they've got a sort of like official now relationship with Spirit of Shankly, which was in the first place set up to effectively oust the previous ownership. So that's an enormous difference in the space of 15 years. And they've been helpful on various different things to do with stuff in the community and things like that. But also the reaction to like the Champions League final this summer and stuff was good in a way that I think you wouldn't necessarily have got from ownerships of other football clubs. So that to me is the main one, because that's the one that affects us directly. You know, I'm sure that the manager does really like them, but I can't say for certain because I don't know how they actually work together on a day-to-day basis. But the one that I do know about is the difference between what I felt like in 2010. You know, I was like 14, 15, and we were taking like spray painted bed sheets like to the match or around the ground to do things. Like, we were kids, we were not even near adulthood, and it was the right thing to do. But it's just insane to look back on that was like what,
lighting on beach balls and throwing them on the pitch.
that was what we were doing, and that's what we perceived as normal. To now be at the point where it feels like they've done plenty of wrong from a supporter point of view, but that ultimately they want to do right and have righted wrongs when they've made them, I think is a very, very significant change. And the idea of that being different means that my default position, and I think that the natural and the right default position to have is nervousness, not necessarily fear about who they would be replaced by, but nervousness, because things like that are then inherently at risk. You know, you might get some billionaire who's incredibly wealthy and lashes a load of money on players. They could just fucking lash the ticket prices up to whatever he wants. Could just fuck every supporter over in every regard. Could stop doing infrastructure. Could stop doing things in the local area with charities and foundations and things like that. That to me wouldn't be better. That'd be loads worse. So that's the thing that I feel is the most kind of concrete. That's the most tangible for all of us that like go the match, or even if you don't go the match, that has impact on you. And that to me is the thing that I think that has been loads and loads of progress over. Yet despite them stepping into sort of various bear traps along the way, and that's the thing that I'm kind of most conscious of, I think.
And I think people forget that. I think we have to be honest with ourselves as well, as fans, and there's a lot of false flags, a lot of criticism that FSG have got has been warranted, like for all the details you put there. Weirdly enough, I don't think the transfer thing is something you can throw at them, because I just think the way they run the club, they are naturally conservative, they're dogmatic, they have a system, and they're an investment group. Now, you know, the argument is that, oh, maybe once or twice they could have pushed the boat out, but if you break that model, how many times do you break it? You know what I mean? If you deviate, then once you've done it once, you're going to do it again and again and again. But what I would say is that they've been, for reasons detailed there, receptive. I actually think, let's be honest, when I talk about honesty, what I'm saying is this. If you own a football club, you're never going to be popular. You're never going to please it. Unless, this is where we need to be honest. Do we want the owner that's going to, do we basically want a petrostate or royal state? Because unless you're getting that, you're never gonna get these super owners who just, you know, these benevolent billionaires who get the culture of the city, invest publicly, do everything you want, sign, you know, £200 million players or £200 million contracts. I mean, I don't see, and correct me if I'm wrong, maybe Brighton are the exception to this, but I don't see in the UK an ownership group that is as responsive to the fan base and that are willing, when they make huge missteps, to correct them and correct them publicly, but also sincerely as well. That's what I've seen.
The difference as well between what you would sort of expect and rightly expect of a group of incredibly wealthy people and these ones, I think, is that there hasn't been that level of arrogance of, well, we just know best because we're the really wealthy people that own this thing. They've made loads of errors along the way, but I think, as you say, have been really open and to listening, because they've recognised that, like, people, it often just people like us, people that go to the match, or whether it be different experts to do with football or whatever, know better than them.
Maybe they've realised that working with us is better than working against us.
Yes, and there's therefore a lack of arrogance that I think is really useful and is certainly by no means guaranteed with some other very wealthy person that could be interested in buying Liverpool.
I think for me, just to be clear, I've never, and I said it before, I've never really come on a show and said, listen, they need to get out the club, because I think you have got to be careful what you wish for. And some of the stuff that the lads have outlined there, no, I absolutely do not want to see as part of this football club. But my view has always been, you know, and why I've challenged them on various shows at times and said things that's maybe been critical of them, is because I think they can be better. And it's always about, can you be a bit better than what you've been in certain moments? And I think some of the things that Dan outlined before, you know, the missteps around the ticket pricing and the furlough and the trademark and all that kind of stuff, it upset me at the time and it annoyed me at the time because it was really easily avoidable mistakes. Yeah. And that led me down a path of, if we are all to accept that these are incredibly intelligent people, they very much were of the mindset of, how far can we push these and how far can we take the piss? And if we have to row back, we'll row back. But what we'll do first, we'll try and take the piss a little bit and we'll see if we can get it past them. Because we know they're going to be pissed off, but just how pissed off are they going to be? Can we ride some of this? And I never liked that as a stance. Mm. And it felt like that was the stance. We can take the piss a little bit here. Because, Neil, they could have asked multiple people on a number of those subjects, how's this going to land? I'll tell you how it's going to land. It's going to land like a fucking shit sandwich, and you know it will. But can we ride the storm a little bit? And that's where I often got upset with them. Not necessarily about transfers, yes. I think there's times, I said it before, they could have done a little bit more for them. And I said they could have pushed the boat out. I disagree with Andy on, if they do it once, they've got to do it all the time. I don't think that's the case at all. But I think in certain crucial moments,
you can have a break glass emergency thing, can't you?
In certain crucial moments, you can. An example being, Liverpool go to Crystal Palace, they win 7-0. The top of the league by 5 points going into Christmas, they could have done something that maybe results in Liverpool picking up another league title. Now, it might not have worked that way, but they're the moments where you think, from a sporting perspective, you could do a little bit more. The same going into this season, where you think you're leaving yourself a little bit short. And that's where I understand the frustration around the transfer stuff. And then there's the other frustrations, the off-the-pitch stuff, which I think they've been poor at times. And I think my thing to them was always, lads, just be a little bit better. It's not a case of, we want you out the club, because that careful what you wish for is a thing. And I am nervous about what comes next, because, you know, it doesn't sit comfortable with me. that you're going to have maybe an All-State come in, and yes, you'll get all these players and all that, but it's never been win at all costs for me. It's never been win at all costs, and I do think there's a balance, and I think at times they could have just done things a little smarter and a little better that would have made the whole process a little bit easier.
What Ian's articulating there, Phil, is I think, and again, some people listening may well feel quite the opposite, and I'm conscious of that. Some people may well be of the view, we'll take anyone, we'll take the wealthiest possible person. The thing I'm, from the people I speak to on a regular basis, I'm hearing a lot of FSG plus. We like FSG plus. My question on that is, first and foremost, do you agree? But my sort of follow-up question becomes, if so, what matters more, the FSG bit or the plus bit? And that is the, you know, as Ian sort of phrased it there, let's be clear about this, the missteps that Dan said they've been quick to correct. We can praise them for being quick to correct, but they made the missteps in the first place. It's worth pointing that out. There is the, does the plus bit include that? Is the plus bit solely transfers? Literally, I'm sort of asking you in the most general way, you get to, within reason, reshape the universe. What is it that you want?
I genuinely have no idea. I genuinely don't know. The thing about the FSG plus for me is that we're now in a situation where FSG can do the FSG plus thing, because we've spent, since what, 2014, 2013, we've been building two stands and a training ground. That's probably, what, $250 million? And I'm pretty sure that we've paid for this stand and the training ground out of money. There's no loans involved, and it's basic. I think they're paid for now. Is that right, Andy, do you know?
I don't think there's any
a great deal of future money. So if you think about the fact that we've taken that out and increased the revenues by having the two bigger stands and the money that they bring in, FSG have got themselves into a position where they can just be FSG plus themselves. So why is someone else going to come in and just do the same thing? Like, what is in it for them? It's a bit, I just don't, this is why the whole thing is really confusing to me, is I don't know why, what the purpose is for someone buying us, because even the sports, I don't think the sports washing even works, because it feels like a bit like sponsoring a ground that exists and that everyone's still going to call it the same thing. And it doesn't, it's, you know, like, you look at PSG, Manchester City and Newcastle are the three main things that happened to this, aren't you? And you can see how all three of those were appealing to people because they were taken over with something and we think, right, well, we can make them better. Like PSG, for example, PSG have been a bit of a joke, by and large, when you consider that they are the football club of Paris, which is one of the most well-known, famous cities in the world. And they've not really done anything of note until...
Well, they got relegated.
Exactly, they didn't do anything. Yeah, exactly.
They were about the sixth or seventh.
They were just the middle of the road. France, but then you see what they can do, and they have done it. You see the same with Manchester City. You see how they can make Newcastle the same. They've got a massive ground. They are a genuine sleeping giant. What are they doing with Liverpool? I don't see what they would do. But I don't see, at the other end of the scale, how an owner slightly different to FSG or broadly the same, what's in it for them? And this is the whole thing. It's a bit concerning for me about who is it who's going to buy us and what are their motives. And I can't figure out. I think the most likely thing is that they sell some of it, and that feels how it will work. But again, what's in it for them? I just, it's really hard for me to sort of work out who these people are, what they would do, and what their end game is.
We need to be honest with ourselves. Like, what do we do? Because you can only fail as owner of Liverpool Football Club unless you're winning the league or the Champions League every year. As we've seen, you can only fail. You'll never be universally popular. And if the club's at its market cap now, which you're probably right, it is, because they've done the grounds, the infrastructure of the club is solid. They've got the training grounds. What comes next?
The only thing is if you can make the ground bigger, and I broadly think that's pretty much impossible.
Well, I mean, you could if the will, but the investment to do that again is exponential.
The money that you would put into it, you're not getting back again. No. So it's a bit,
But I think on this, Dan, a lot of this has got to be seen in the context, the wider context of football. There's literally this World Cup is going on at the same time. The ESL versus UEFA court case is ongoing. I think that if UEFA don't win that, and I am obviously no legal expert, but people who are don't think UEFA will win in its entirety, to say the least. There'll be something in there. I think that'll be a game changer in some way. You know, I'm not saying positive or negative here, far from it. Like, I the either partial investment thing that Phil talks about or a complete takeover. I think it's someone thinking, and this has long been my position, I think if you're Fenway Sports Group and hedge funds are about risk, and I think right now you've got this thing, and let's just say it's worth $4 billion because it makes the maths easier for me. So I think there's a pathway to that thing being worth at some point in the next 10 years, $8 billion, and that's predominantly around media rights and stuff like that. There is also a pathway to that thing being worth $2 billion. So yes, right now, if you're Fenway Sports Group, they may feel it is a good time to go into a
marketplace. But you're not going to make 10 times your money like they're going to, though.
No, and that's your gamble, that whoever comes in, that's the gamble that they will have. Yeah. But we'll feel in the meantime, the thing about this asset, though, is we can have a level of confidence, we can keep it at around the $4 billion mark over a period, and then at some point it may well move forward. You're not going to get to $40 billion. I take the point on that from Andy, but that's why I think it's in Fenway's interest right now to go, you know what, this is now where we find ourselves. We've gone through all of this once. Maybe now this is the point at which we just say, you know what, see you later, and leave someone else with this bit of risk.
Yeah, it's something like 1200 to 1400% worth of increase on something that only happened 12 years ago. A transaction that's barely over a decade old. It's an incredible like transformation in an economic point of view, and I do think that Chelsea being sold probably hurries it along a little bit more, because it's just very rare that a very similar business, a similar size and similar type of business is sold, and you can go, well, obviously the circumstances are different in terms of geography and status and stuff like that, but that's a very near number to what we can be asking for. Then we could maybe be a little bit more, could maybe be a little bit less, but we've got a real solid ballpark figure there. So I think that makes it more appealing to them to sell. I think the fact that we may be in a really, really terrible decade globally, economically, also makes it appealing, because I would say that I totally take the point that it could be worth $8 billion within 10 years' time. But I think with every passing day, it's less likely, and it's nothing to do with football. And thirdly, if things like expansions in American sports, you will know more, but apparently there might be new NFL teams at some point. If they, as a group of American sports business people, would like to part own or fully own a new NFL side or an NBA
There's
side.
There's an NFL
whatever.
Side for sale at the minute.
Is it the Washington one?
Washington Commanders, yeah. They're bringing in, I think, two more NBA teams as their plan, and one of them's going to be in Las Vegas, which is going to be seriously lucrative, I think.
The Formula One is going to Las Vegas next year as well, so if you're going to buy a sports team that might be based in Las Vegas, this is a really good time in which to be doing it, because there's going to be an awful lot of capital and sporting events floating around there, even more so than normal. So I think all of those things together add up to this just makes loads of sense at this point. If we can get rid of it, I think it also explains why they're not absolutely desperate to. But touting it publicly, both through the sort of very nondescript, vague statement they gave to Ornstein, and then Tom Werner just sort of outright saying it to the Boston Globe, that's more significant than just sort of like casual. That's a way of really inviting people to come and say to you, I would like to pay $4.5 billion for this, please, or I would like to pay $1.5 billion for 40% of this, or whatever it may be. In terms of who it could be, I agree with Phil in that I don't really know. I know lots of things I don't want. I don't necessarily
I've
know
got
what
a remarkably
I,
strong yeah,
I don't really know what I do want, because I think that what you end up with what you do want either doesn't really quite exist, or if it does exist, I don't really see what's in it for them.
Yeah.
Apart from a possibility of increasing financial value, but it's not a dead strong possibility. So it would have to be, well, who benefits from sort of like the association with it? So I take the point on sports washing and things like that. Normally they buy at a really low price. They improve everything and everyone gets to go, oh, look what they've done for them. They've taken them from being, you know, 18th, 19th or whatever,
that's the point, though. They become the story, becomes exactly. Well, rejuvenating.
I think
whoever owns Liverpool, it'll still be, it'll just be Liverpool.
I do agree with
that. Every year, you're not doing anything.
I do agree with that. I still think there are potential benefits in that. One of the things that people often don't think of when they talk about the sports washing is that it's not just football. All of these places put loads of money into the places themselves, and not for particularly good purposes an awful lot of the time. So in Manchester, for example, there is an awful lot of UAE-owned affordable housing, in inverted commas, that is not affordable housing, but that they have purchased the land at a dead cheap price and they now own the land. There's an awful lot that's gone on between France and Qatar over the years. One of the main reasons that Qatar has got the World Cup is because Nicolas Sarkozy, who was the French president at the time, basically gave his blessing to it as part of the deal that PSG would be bought, and therefore France and Paris's influence on a global sporting level would be increased. So there can still be reasons why a state would potentially go, we might not be able to become the whole story around that, but by being associated with it, we can gain in a sense. There's not that many of them left, though, that would want to do it, I don't think. I mentioned in a thing I wrote at the time a couple of weeks ago that the Bahrain seems like the next one because they have tried to buy a football club. One of their investment vehicles tried to buy Milan earlier this year. Red Bull bought it instead. The actual kingdom of Bahrain itself, not even the Sovereign Wealth Fund, I don't think, owns what is currently a minority stake in Paris FC, which is a second division club.
It feels
France.
Like it could be great needle long term, that doesn't it?
So, well, yeah, the derby becomes Bahrain versus Qatar within probably 5 to 10 years, is what I suspect. But if, because that's the kingdom that owns it, one of their investment vehicles could own another club, because it's technically two different things that own it, even though it would be for the exact same purpose. So I think, I'm not saying that they will buy Liverpool. I have no information that suggests they will buy Liverpool, but they are the next sort of state with an awful lot of money that clearly would be interested in buying a football club. The other thing, sorry, I know I've been talking for a while, but the other thing that I think is interesting and that I've been thinking about in the past few days that might end up being suitable for everybody is... So Lewis Hamilton recently was one of the people that invested in the Dallas Cowboys.
Denver Broncos.
And when Chelsea were up for sale, him, Serena Williams, a couple of others were part of the Broughton-led consortium, I think it was, that wanted that. Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy have just started doing their that like golf thing, whatever it is, Phil.
Yeah, like, he started like it. I can't remember exactly what it is, but he's got loads of people involved.
It's some
in
sort
thing,
of golf entertainment thing that about 50 different major sports people are involved with. There are 6 or 7 Formula One drivers that are invested in it.
Rory McIlroy's in it.
There are various NBA and NFL people that are in it. But Rory McIlroy and Tiger Woods are like the main ones that have put this together. It's some sort of like indoor. It looks a bit like Laser Quest, like for golf or something like that. It's some sort of like mad tournament.
Oh, I've seen it, yeah.
But anyway, my point is that what an awful lot of sports people, like really top-end, extremely wealthy sports people are doing now is associating themselves directly with sports teams and sports brands in order to protect their financial assets after they finish their careers, first of all. But also, in terms of to give themselves something to do, because they've all got to retire at about the age of 35 or 40.
Michael Jordan just owns a team.
Exactly. And we've already seen it must have been almost a decade ago at this point that LeBron James has had a stake in Liverpool, technically.
In FSG, I think.
In FSG and therefore in Liverpool. So maybe there's something around the fact that, I mean, it would benefit the club and FSG to be associated with, like, say, 10 billionaire sports people or whatever if they fancied doing it. And maybe it would suit them to all collectively own, I don't know, 20-25% of Liverpool or something like that. They could put the capital together for that. And there would be other, you know, non-sporting wealthy people that were involved. Again, none of this is coming off anything other than a hunch, but they're all clearly dead interested in it because there've been 4 or 5 different transactions this year that they've either done and completed, or have spoken publicly about being very interested in. Both Hamilton and Serena Williams were asked questions publicly about Chelsea and talked up the idea of being part owners of it. Said that they wanted to have like an active role and stuff like that if it went through, not just sort of wait and watch the money roll in. So I think that something like that is a possibility, and you know the marketing potential that would come from that would be something that a group of people like FSG could maybe be convinced, well, actually, that could take the value of this thing up, and maybe it's worth us sticking around.
And this is part of what I think, you know, Mike Gordon's role will come into play, because I think the interview you did, Neil, with Ben Jacobs at CBS, he kind of alludes to that Gordon's almost now going to be this kind of facilitator person where he'll start to maybe bring people together a little bit to see whether that's potentially an opportunity where you're bringing multiple investors together, and, you know, kind of, you know, backs up what Dan's saying there to a point. But I think the other thing he mentions, and I think, unlike Phil, I do see them wanting to sell the whole thing. I take Ben's point that he makes on the chat with you, where if they want to get a feel for what the full value is, maybe they sell 10% at 300 million just to demonstrate it's worth this amount of money. I understand that. But I do think the end game here is to sell the full asset. But his point, which he made, which is really right, is that you've got to get through an awful lot of potential interest. I think there was 500 kind of potential interests in Chelsea, and only 12 of them actually had any kind of worthwhileness to them in terms of follow-ups and stuff. So I think this process may be slightly longer than we think. unless actually it's further down the line than we currently know. And I thought it might be, but after listening to that chat, I'm not too sure now.
Just on that, I'll come back to you. And I think a lot of people at the time when it first broke with The Athletic, there was a sense of this will be further along than you think. And actually, I now actually
think complete opposite.
Yeah. That's not what I think. I could be wrong, but I now think it's the complete opposite.
No, I think it does lead you down that path a little bit. I think just in terms of why they're choosing to sell now, we did a show maybe 18 months ago and we talked about FSG and when we think their tenure might end. And for me, I never saw it going past Jurgen Klopp. And I know that won't be the only reason for this. It just won't be. There's lots of reasons. The lads have touched on some of it. You know, the Chelsea stuff, the current economic climate is definitely a factor. I think there's lots of factors. But I never, ever saw it going past the manager. And I think it's becoming more and more difficult for them as an ownership group now. The way FFP's gone, I think they held that quite tightly to themselves, thinking, well, if that goes the way we think it should go, then we're in a really strong position. But we know that's not the case. You can pretty much do what you want, and there's no real sanctions, there's no real follow-up. So that's gone against them in a massive way. And I think also, where you look where the team is right now, it does need significant investment. Are you willing to go and do that? And are you willing to go and do it past the manager's tenure, which is what, another 2 or 3 years? Another 3 years, I think it is, and maybe 4 years. But it's not that long. And I think this becomes very difficult with, I think, someone at the helm other than the manager that we've got now. I do. I think Pep Guardiola is probably one of, if not the best manager in world football alongside Jurgen Klopp. I don't think he has the same success that Jurgen has if he was in charge of Liverpool. I think it's very difficult to look at what he's done at City, and he's done lots of wonderful things, but he still can't win a Champions League with all the money he's got.
Just on your point here around sort of length of time anyway, I mean, they're at 12 years now. I sort of, you know, looking into this, obviously the ownership structure was different and eras are different, but David Moyes is chairman of the club from 91 to 07 for the vast majority of that with a majority shareholding. John Smith was chairman 73 to 90. That was prior to David Moyes amalgamating the 51% that he firstly did when he built the centenary stand. So ownership structure is a little bit different there. You've got sort of Peter Robinson and Rick Parry's influence sort of consistent. I mean, Robinson, I think, almost certainly, definitely prior to John Smith in 73, but, you know, sort of as key administrators in there. But it's just interesting to me that, you know, there's two periods that are 16 years, 17 years. FSG is now at 12 years. You mentioned the manager's contract. That'd take them to 16 years. Latterly, in the Robinson and Parry camp, that now appears to be Mike Gordon. So the idea that he's overseeing the sales process, to me, makes it really sort of seem like this is such a live runner and rider. That to me, there's two marker points that is to me. One, it's nowhere near as far along as a lot of people said it will be when the thing first broke, because why is he going to go and oversee it now? Why hasn't he been doing that before? But two, the extent to which he is the key decision-making guy around Liverpool Football Club for FSG says that this is a real live thing that is happening right now. But it is interesting, isn't it? You know, in the history of Liverpool Football Club, 12 years of you being responsible for it or running it seems almost like about par, to be honest with you, and hence there's a bit of a ticking clock.
Yeah, maybe so, and I think, you know, the point's been made around, you know, how much more attractive will Liverpool become? I think, listen, there'll always be a status thing. Liverpool doesn't come up very often. Clubs like Liverpool do not come on the market very often. That will be attractive to people with lots and lots of money. But the point around, you know, not going past Jurgen's time, Jurgen being at the helm is hugely attractive, I think, to someone, because he is simply, in my opinion, the greatest at what he does. So that's a massive selling point. Though, you come and buy this football club, it's one hell of a monster of a club. We picked it up when it was on its knees, and, you know, sometimes I don't quite get the, you know, FSG coming and they were the saviour and all that. Listen, they saw an opportunity. They saw an opportunity, and fair fucks to you, because if you had the money at the time, if you had the money at the time, why wouldn't you? Because Liverpool was never going to depreciate. It was only going to go from strength from that point. And they've done what they set out to do. You know, they've come in, they've made a load of money. And listen, trophies have been put in the cabinet and stuff. But I do think having the manager there right now, that's attractive to anyone who comes in after them. If Jurgen leaves and then you've got to kind of bring someone in and you've got to do the rebuilding process, and I don't know how much that takes to suddenly kind of maybe get Liverpool back to where they are challenging for the title, because they fell away. There's no argument this season. They're nowhere near it at the minute. I think it becomes more difficult. So I completely can see the sense why they're looking at moving on now. It makes perfect sense to me.
Phil, the first part of this, the dark side of this process is, for, well, it doesn't need to necessarily be dark, but the dark side of this process is, to me, you know, it's worth remembering Moores was trying to sell stakes in Liverpool for at least 18 months. What legacy actually means here, and does it genuinely matter to Fenway Sports Group if they are walking away completely, is something that's up in the air. And whether or not this proves disruptive, I can't quite get my head around that, because I think that the one thing that's not, most definitely not right now in Fenway Sports Group's interest is this asset depreciating in any way, shape or form. They want it to be boosted and boosted. But if this is a 9-month process from now, that does take in the next two transfer windows, for instance. And it does sort of throw open a couple of questions around that. But as you say, you know, a lot of the sort of capital spend that Liverpool have made on infrastructure is about to be all but paid for at the same time. And, you know, there's other questions around where the money is or isn't moving in Liverpool. This is a long question, Phil, with about 16 clauses, so all the best.
I wish I'd made notes here, you know. I wish I'd made notes. I'll start with the legacy, I think. And then I'll probably have forgotten the rest of the question, so it might just be a one-answer thing. But I think the legacy matters for a variety of reasons, in that some people just go, oh, you'll take the money, they'll get the money, and then they'll go. Well, we mentioned about an NFL team, for example, before. So when you buy an NFL team, 24 of the other 31 owners have to vote for you and approve it. So if you have a history of a badly run sports team, that they've seen it fall off a cliff, or they've seen X, Y, and Z that they don't like the look of, you know, if you get 8 of these people that go, no, you're not for me, then it doesn't matter whether you want it or not, you just can't have it, because they're sort of, it's similar to the Premier League in that they're controlled, and they've got a fellow called Roger Goodell who's like the commissioner, but they are sort of controlled in a way that it is a bit internally ran. So if you want to be in this thing, you've got to make it look like that you're competent and capable, and you obviously have incompetent, incapable NFL owners, but at the time they displayed something that meant that they looked like they were worthy of owning it. So stuff like that from a legacy point of view means that they have to make it look good, and they won't want to leave it in a mess. And as you say, this is a depreciation thing, and they make it appealing if this Liverpool team, for example, let's say they're still 100% owners next summer, if this Liverpool team is, you know, signed 2 or 3 top level players who slot into the first team, make the first team stronger, have people thinking that Liverpool are going to win the European Cup and the league, and just go back to the sort of teams that were winning, you know, capable of winning 15 games in a row, that looks better not only for them, but it also looks more appealing to someone who wants in, because I don't think someone wants to come in with an asset where you're going to have to pay a shed load of money and want to do a great deal with it from the off. Like, it's all well and good taking over, you know, Mashiri comes in Everton and he can sit down and go, right, well, I want to do this, this, this and this, because it needs to be done. And you can see how, I mean, he's made a really bad job of Everton, but you can see how he could have done all of the things that he's done and made Everton a, you know, a top 6, top 4
by not paying much money in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah. So they don't have to invest their money in the team. These people have got to invest a lot of money into the club just to buy it before they've even thought about it. So they probably don't, they don't want to leave someone with work to do, really. They want to live in a sort of a level of, you know, freedom to do some stuff. But if you're spending $3 billion on an asset, you don't want to do things with it, do you, really? You just want it to be ready to go, plug in and play, and go sit back and go, right, this is sound. I'm going to try and make it worth a little bit more. We'll try and win some things and we'll see where we are. So the legacy thing, I think, is genuinely important for a variety of reasons.
But will it prove disruptive? Because this is, you know...
Sorry, I knew I'd forgot something.
That's all right. No, it's all right. I think you can't say this one. Will it prove disruptive? Because this is, you know, the first thing that I want to know about as a Liverpool supporter, Ian. Both in the now, but also in the 3 months, 6 months, 9 months down the line, if that's what we are indeed looking at across all of this. You know, as I always say, there are football matches to be played. You can't avoid them. Sadly, they make you play them. And in this instance, I agree with Phil in general, but it doesn't, to me, for instance, make a clarity around all decision-making straightforward if people are concerned or wondering or just left in a degree of doubt about what is next.
Yeah, and that's the unknown, isn't it? We don't quite know what does come next. And you would hope, and I've heard you say it on shows, Neil, you know, you don't want this asset, if you want to call it that, for the purpose of this conversation, to depreciate. So you suddenly stop investing, you suddenly stop doing those things, you suddenly find yourself out of the Champions League, then, you know, you are going to lose money when you come to cash your chips in, because it doesn't all of a sudden look as attractive. So they have got to have an eye on that. And I think think it was the manager who said, you know, we didn't see anything changing across the next kind of couple of transfer windows. I know other people have said things as well around Liverpool will continue to operate as they have done in recent times. I mean, I'd hope for maybe a little bit more of that, if I'm honest. But, you know, we'll see where we go in January and the summer market. Because I think, again, the point was made on the interview you did, you know, even if this is to be a very, very quick sale, you're still looking at 9 months. So, you know, that's time where they've got to see some investment in the team, because Liverpool simply cannot afford to be out of the Champions League. And if they are, you know, someone's rightly going to come knocking on the door and saying, well, you know, you wanted this price for it, but if they're not on the top table, then we will pay you this price. So I think they're going to have to look to invest. Whether they're willing to go that kind of, that extra mile on one or two players, they might just take a little bit of a gamble. And again, sometimes it just comes back to, well, we think the manager can get more out of this set of players or that set of players. And I think, you know, when you had that conversation with him in the summer, and he kind of said he didn't want any kind of midfielders, and at the time everyone thought, well, does he really mean that? I think there's been times recently where maybe Jürgen's just, he's got a little bit frustrated and he's had to just back his lads because he knows he's maybe not going to get the player over the line that he wants. And the more I think about that conversation you had with him, the more I think there's a lot of chat about Liverpool just needing to do something in midfield. And we all know these lads dipping in and out of the internet. And at some point, he's just got to go, well, I've got to back my lads here. Otherwise, like, it just looks like we haven't got a very good football team. And people are going to be reading this going, well, am I not that good anymore? Am I not part of the manager's plans? So I almost think, you know, when they were looking at the likes of a Tchouaméni, for instance, maybe it was him or no one, because we know they are willing to go the extra mile on certain players, but maybe it is only very specific ones. And if you don't get that one, then we'll go and put our chips elsewhere, maybe on a centre forward, for instance. And in the end, I think the manager just thought, you know what, I've just got to back the lads I've got here. And that's why he comes out a little bit later on and says the thing about taking more risk, and he was disappointed that we maybe didn't take a little bit more risk, and if it was up to him, he'd make slightly different decisions. And he says the same thing in that January window when we haven't got the centre half, and he says, I'm only responsible for kind of part of this, I don't make the full decision. So I think there's going to have to be maybe some uncomfortable conversations between the two, where you say, listen, you know, we're going to need investments here. If you want us to get to the point where we're back in the Champions League and we're fighting on all fronts, this team does need reinforcing.
I struggle in the wider context to sort of understand here how, whether it's 5 years, whether it's 10 years from now, we don't end up as the baddies. Whether we immediately become the baddies, Dan, or whether or not we don't end up no matter what. I think the ESL UEFA court case thing is the unexploded bomb in European football that people have just sort of taken their eye off for a number of reasons. But I don't quite understand the paying of £4 billion if you're not, for instance, going to be prepared to be really aggressive around, for example, a shift in media rights in order to grow the asset. That will lead, you know, and this is part of, people get annoyed when I call Liverpool a super club. Those people are just wrong. But also there's an element where part of this is Liverpool will be the people who are absolutely pushing for there being a shift which allows them to have new income streams with which to grow. That will lead to Liverpool being criticised in a number of places in the more conservative elements, whether rightly or wrongly, whether harshly or otherwise. But I just don't quite see a procedure here where somebody's stumping up £3 billion and there isn't a point somewhere down the line where we're all having to have another series of conversations, the like of which we've had to have around FSG. We just might be dealing with somewhat more determined people, because the thing about FSG was they only paid £280 million for it with a little bit on top. Whoever comes in next has paid £3-4 billion and may well be thinking, go fuck yourselves, I paid £3 or £4 billion.
Yeah, if you've paid that amount of money and your goal, it wouldn't necessarily be everybody's goal, but it would be for the vast majority of people that could buy Liverpool, is to make that a higher amount. You know, we've all said at various points that it's hard to kind of picture how that figure would rise. In the current structure of global football, yes. I think it's hard to, you know, if we were looking at the competitions all being run in the same way, the way that things are divided all being the same way in 10 years' time, then yes, I don't think Liverpool will be worth an awful lot more than what it currently is. But ways of making it more valuable would be to do things like insist...
FIFA Club World Cup, where you get insist, gets
well if we sort of start at maybe a more sort of basic level, no less nefarious, but a more basic level, would be for someone to come in and insist, hang on, so the thing that I've bought is worth £4 billion and provides an awful lot of the value to this league, but a team that's worth maybe 150 million quid or 200 million, like Bournemouth, for example, gets an even split of the TV revenue. That's a fucking piss take. I wouldn't say that, but that's what somebody...
Remember when I tried to do that? It went exactly down like a fucking level.
But that's what somebody who's paid £4.5 billion, who might be a lot more bloody-minded, as you say, than what Femi Schwartz group of being might say. That's more like a fundamental thing. That's still within the current structure of football that we have. But then, yes, someone might go, oh, yeah, that idea that they just sort of got put on the back burner before the pandemic, yep, of this 2014 Club World Cup every summer in China. Bring that back. Because we'll make an awful lot of money off that. Or the idea of playing competitive Liverpool fixtures abroad. Yeah, really good. It'd be really good to play the Champions League final in New York. Or the idea of playing a two-legged semi where one is in New York and one is in LA or something like that. Or, yes, let's go back to this Super League idea. The previous ownership went for it and then were too cowardly to pursue it or something like that. All of those things are potential either new revenue streams or just increasing existing revenue streams that would take it from, yes, say, 4.5 billion to 6 billion within 5 years or something like that. I wouldn't want any of those things to happen, though. So if we're talking about, you know, you mentioned sort of this FSG plus before, if the plus is, well, all right, well, let's spend more money on footballers, but they're going to really push down on all of these things, then fuck that. I don't want that. I have no interest in the in Liverpool being the purveyors of disrupting the foundations of football, which are already incredibly undemocratic, but I don't want them to be even less democratic than what they already are. So you're right to say about fundamentally, because Liverpool is worth a certain amount, it is a super club, and therefore whoever owns it has an awful lot of power in order to shape the way that the whole sport, the whole industry, even the sort of wider cultural industry, therefore, goes across the next however long they would own it for, decade, two decades, however long it would be. And I, you know, obviously, anyone that probably has listened to any of us talk before would know full well that we wouldn't be interested in a state owning Liverpool. But I also don't want whoever it would be that takes over Liverpool to sort of have all of these things at the top of their agenda in order to increase the financial value of the club. Because to me, it would be to the detriment of Liverpool from a sport and a meta perspective, but also the rest of football as a whole.
Ian and Andy.
I think the Super League point that Dan makes, I don't think that's going away. I think there's still enough big clubs championing that for it to come back on the radar at some point. And maybe it comes back, you know, stealth-like, but I think it does come back. And there was the Project Big Picture stuff, wasn't there, as well, that Liverpool and United were kind of driving forward. And it was the one that I think Rick Parry was very keen on, because he saw it as a way of... His view was distributing money
same
down
the EFL pyramid, clubs, yeah.
Yeah, but I think it was just using the parachute payments in a kind of creative way, and that was all about giving a number of clubs the kind of power, wasn't it, a veto? And I think it was 9 clubs. I think they had to stretch it out to 9 to get Man City included, because there was something around clubs who've been in the Premier League longer than Man City and all that kind of stuff, Everton being one. So I think it would have been 9 clubs who'd had the power and stuff. And again, that's another angle where you can see someone coming in and maybe looking at, well, actually, how can we restructure the kind of finances, not too dissimilar to what Dan's just said there, where actually all the big clubs get to say, all the big clubs get a say in how the money's funneled and where it goes. So that is...
And the media rights thing on...
Yeah, and the media rights stuff as well. So that's where someone will have their eye on this. You know, what there is still stuff we can do. But that makes you nervous, because it's a lot of stuff that just goes against everything I want to see from football. And listen, a lot of people around this table are all of the same age, and we understand and we see football and we view football in a certain way.
Marshall,
and we
absorb...
Yeah.
I mean, you have
considered a lot of people. Didn't say all.
Second youngest here.
Phil's the oldest, obviously. So they all see it in a certain way, and I think, you know, that goes against the grain for me. You know, I all of that stuff, the Super League stuff, which, you know, back to the FSG point four, was an absolute fucking shambles that was tried to be kind of brought in the way it was. You know, to the point where you're throwing players and the manager under the bus with you knew nothing about it. You know, that was... they got off lightly, in my view, on some of that. But that's where you see a potential owner coming in and just looking at it and think there is potential money to be made here, but it leads you down a series of paths that don't feel very good in terms of how you will consume your football.
Okay, Andy, and then we're going to have to wrap up. Go on, Andy.
There is an alternative to this, and it's just me maybe overthinking things, but the tech sector. So we talk about media rights, broadcast rights, whatever. Peter Moore was obsessed with turning Facebook likes and turning them into revenue, and that makes perfect sense given his background with EA Sports. And you know, so for instance, with EA made more money off FIFA with the loot boxes that you buy and stuff like that than they actually did with the purchase of the game. And if you speak to anyone in tech, and I've seen Steve Ballmer linked and stuff like that, everyone's convinced that how we consume sports over the next 10, 15 years is going to change.
Yeah.
You know, you've got this thing about attention spans in kids or young adults is only something like, I don't know, was it 3 minutes or 4 minutes or something like that?
I know, it's a nightmare dealing with
Dan. But the point I'm making is, if there's a someone from the tech sector sees something like Liverpool is big enough to drive and innovate change in football, you know, maybe that would be attractive. And what would that ownership look like? You know, would it? Because there's certainly the money there to do it. I just think we're in this weird state of flux at the minute as well. So BT don't want Premier League football, let's be honest, anymore. They're trying to get rid of it. Amazon are trying to slowly test the water a little bit, especially around Christmas, you know, sell them Amazon cards. And the value of the TV deal with Sky isn't rising anywhere near as exponentially as what it has done previously. Maybe I'm just spitballing, but there have been names linked. And, you know, look at how we live our daily lives now. I mean, the typical example with what's in the news now with Elon Musk. Who dared? What was Twitter 10 years ago?
It's an excellent point.
Do you know what I mean?
I think it's as good an example as the way in which the thing is consumed.
It could just be something different.
But that's also a media rights thing, because Sky won't be happy if you can watch. What's Facebook being renamed, Phil?
But everyone's convinced about the metaverse and being able to sit in, put a virtual headset on and have basically a virtual season ticket. As if you're in the start, and it sounds ridiculous, but it's not. That's what.
No, it's possible, and things could move in that general direction.
So virtual headsets and like Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal playing each other at half time around Fiat,
and it'd still
because they own the club is what I think we've settled on. We would quite like
Serena Williams as well.
I'll ask 50 quid in if this is a thing,
and it'd still be noisier than the Centenary Stand.
Serena Williams as Reds is what I'm all about. You've got to work harder on getting on the back of the linesman down where you are, as far as I'm concerned. Don't know how you do that in your own front room with a headset on. there'll be more big questions than big answers. Thank you very much indeed to Andy for producing, Sam for doing the video stuff as well, Ian, Dan and Phil. We'll get there eventually. Sports Social Podcast Network.